All right, so welcome to the podcast. Back with producer Jimmy Kennedy. He did an excellent job last week. He's a broadcast veteran coming to you from a
Yes.
former life where he was a radio play-by-play producer for the Colts. I know it's the Indianapolis Colts.
I was
What
an
did you do?
on-field I was an on-field liaison for the team on game days. So, similar to your job, kind of a talent guy who, would introduce himself to the media members if they needed anything, I was a buffer for the communication department, essentially, so it was a cool gig. Got to meet a lot of people through the process, so
That's
yeah,
a
awesome.
great gig. I mean, that's like a dream job for a lot of people. How much did you like that job? Like, how fun is it being on the field before a game on a Sunday? Like, that's a feeling that, like, unless you've been there, it's pretty hard to describe, isn't it?
Well, I mean, you get there if it's a 1 o'clock game, you get there like 8 a.m. So you have breakfast and then you see the game prep go on. And if it's a Sunday night, you're showing up at like 1 o'clock, so, and by halftime, most of the folks, are already done with the media that they have to do. So I ran into Bob Costas of NBC. I mean, so many different people that I've come across, and it's like, man, I was watching that guy when I was, a little kid. Like that's amazing, So I'm not really too starstruck anymore. Maybe if I meet some of your friends, I'll be a little starstruck. But as far as the NFL is concerned, I've met mostly everybody.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. I mean, as you know, I did the Super Bowl for like 12 or 13 years, and it was the same thing, and I'm not even a huge sports nut, but like, it's just crazy. You're down there on the field and you're watching them do the broadcast and the players. We discussed before, when Peyton Manning looked at me with his game face on, it was one of the most terrifying experiences. I told you, he was like stretching his hamstrings, and I was just like an idiot walking around my iPhone before the Super Bowl, like taking pictures. And he just made direct contact with me. Like, he happened to look up right when I was standing there, and he was just like, "What are you doing here, you idiot?"
I met Peyton Manning actually in Washington, D.C. When I was in sixth grade. I was the winner of a competition or an award, the Prudential Spirit of Community Awards, which is hosted in Washington, D.C. every year. And it was the year that the Colts won the Super Bowl. And I was on the bus with some people from New England. So, they're giving me crap about Peyton Manning and how Tom Brady's better. But I ended up meeting him in Washington, D.C. and got to, I think it was at the Museum of Natural History, which is where some of the events with The Apprentice took place, right?
Well, not in DC. Yes, you're correct in that it was the Museum of Natural History, but it was the real one up in New York City, not the Smithsonian one. I'm just kidding. I grew up going to the one you're talking about with the blue whale and everything. I grew up in the DC area before I moved to New York at 13. So, sorry, there's a lot of background doors being opened and shut. Can you hear me? Okay,
We can
cool.
hear
Awkward podcast moment. When I
you.
always say I'm about to do a podcast, not everybody understands like you're about to be recording something, and any kind of loud noise in the background makes it difficult. But that's part of the fun and spontaneity. Anyway, do you want to talk about like why you were there in sixth grade and stuff? I mean, you're a pretty accomplished dude. I think that's a very inspiring, cool story.
My parents got me involved with volunteering very early. And my doctor, Dr. Chuck Dietzen, he's a world-renowned physiatrist. He specializes in rehabilitation. And he founded a global foundation called TIMMY Global Health, TIMMY Global Health. And it expands access to quality health care where there isn't those resources. And I've been speaking professionally on their behalf since the age of five. And I started a professional wrestling charity event because before becoming a medical doctor, Dr. Chuck was a professional wrestler. So he could perform maneuvers in a way that people with disabilities are able to experience being a professional wrestler for a day. Not many kids get to say that. And through everything, we're also able to use the tickets and the raffle items to provide some money for kids to get access to healthcare that we have the advantage of, every day here in the United States. It could be better, certainly for some people, but all in all, we're pretty blessed here in the United States.
That's awesome, man. So you've
Yeah.
been an advocate basically since you were 5 years old.
Yeah, so disability advocate. And when I was in high school and college, I advocated for handrails to the press box and press row because they just don't think about people with disabilities calling games, you know. And I, if somebody with a disability wanted to be a play-by-play or do something in media, I wanted to make sure they could get to the area they needed to go.
Dude, that's so awesome. That's awesome. And your mom told me about that. Your mom's messaged me before. Like it was high school, right? You wanted to call the high school football games and stuff. The press box.
So I went to a high school. It was unbelievable. We ended up calling the national game of the week when I was a junior in high school. There were several guys, Division I players, on the field at one point. Sheldon Day was somebody that went to Notre Dame and ended up playing this past season with the Colts, you know. So he was the highly touted guy that was on the field that day. But you know, it was cool to be the voice of a team, man, and to have a disability and have access to the press box where there's warm food and you know you get to watch the game. It's amazing. You know, instead of having to participate physically on the field, I got to still be involved, you know.
God, that's awesome. And I'll bet you're going to be an inspiration for a lot of kids to come. You know, I bet that'll become like more accessible and more normal, and kids that might have disabilities won't feel excluded. You know, even though they probably can't get on the field and play football, they can still be involved in things they love, you know, and they can still excel and do something that's incredibly difficult, because calling play by play is, you know, it's its own sport and it's its own skill, and it's not something that, you know, just anybody can do. It's something that people with an aptitude should be doing. And you clearly had a talent for that. And you didn't, you know, let circumstances get in your way. Because you don't, you know, disability is like one of those loaded terms. You know, like I don't see anything disabled about you, you know, and I know that's a lot of how you feel. Like I'm ready to take on the world, you know, like just give me a fair shot, you know, and that. You know, that's what it's all about. And that's what our country does at its best. You know, I don't want to veer into politics, but well, what the hell? We might as well. You know, it's about like not leveling, you know, the Republicans. It took about what, 10 minutes before I got into it. The Republicans this week are trying to use voter suppression. You know, and you look at the gerrymandered districts of somebody like Jim Jordan, for example, you know, in a state near yours, next to yours, right? Is Ohio next to Indiana?
Yep,
Yep,
right next.
exactly. So the next state, and if you look at his district, it's just completely gerrymandered. You know, the only reason he wins is because they draw squiggly lines, you know, around whatever areas people that might vote for him live, because they know, you know, if they just draw a big circle, like he's not going to win, because people are going to be like, that guy's a scumbag, get him out of there, you know. But he wants to continue to have power, and he wants to continue to support a party, you know, like the Republican Party, which, as we know now, belongs to Trump. And we'll get into that a little later. But, you know, that's what they want to do. They want to make it an unlevel playing field because they know they cannot compete on merit, you know? And it's not the American way. You know, it's not the things that we celebrate in sport, right? You were talking about Tom Brady, you know, versus, you know, Peyton Manning. The reason like we can have that debate is because those guys can compete on a level playing field, you know, where we can judge their skills and athleticism because it's fair. You know, if the other team could come out and have brass knuckles, you know, under their gloves and just start like punching like the, you know, defensive line or something, it wouldn't be a fair game. It would be like whoever cheated would win. And that's what the Republicans want to do. They don't want a fair game anymore because they know they're not going to win on their merits. They're terrified of AOC. You know, you're going to put a Marjorie Taylor Greene up against an AOC, you know, or a Lauren Boebert, you know, they're going to lose every time. They want to sort of be intellectually lazy. They want to be corrupt, and they want to appeal to, you know, we're white, vote for us. You know, I'll help you keep your guns. You know, it's like, it's insane, you know? So I love sport as a metaphor for that because. And we should think about politics that way. You know, would you tune in every Sunday to watch a game that you know was gerrymandered? You know, that you know, no matter what the other team did, we already made sure they've carved out enough points for the Patriots to win, you know, Sunday after Sunday. I know that's probably a bad example because the Patriots do cheat. But,
I was
but
gonna say,
yeah,
they have
Belichick,
a
you know.
history of that.
Exactly. But you get my point. My point is, if it wasn't fair, it wouldn't be fun. And it's the same way in America. You got to make it fair so you can have the fun and blessings of a rich nation. A bountiful nation comes because people get a fair shot. You don't know who's making the next Star Wars franchise out there, who the next director is. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, who the next, like, sports hero, musical hero? You got to give everybody a fair shot. You can't pick it out and say, oh, maybe the white people are the ones most likely to contribute something to society, so I'm going to make sure they get health care and a good education. And, you know, we don't take care of these brown kids or the children of immigrants and stuff. That's no way to do it. You know, we all lose when you do things that way, because we lose the gifts and blessings of life. One of my greatest heartbreaks about this whole immigration thing is, like, we demonize these people that are just coming here to work hard, you know, mm-hmm. and provide a better life for their kids, you know, and for the next generation. And we make it impossibly hard. And then, you know, during the last 4 years, we locked these people up in cages. How many kids that have been in cages now for 4 years would have been a great doctor, a great scientist, a great, like, author, you know, that would have given something that could have saved lives, enriched lives. And instead, they're dealing with childhood trauma that I don't know how you get over. You know, I don't know how these kids are going to get over what they went through.
Well, and talk about a way to radicalize someone quickly. You know, if that's a way to bring down terrorism, no. I mean, talk about a traumatic, evil thing. You know, let's snatch kids away from their parents. You know, the evil laugh to go along with it. I mean, it's horrifying that we allowed that many kids to just be permanently traumatized. I mean, that should horrify Americans that we allowed that to happen.
No, that's an excellent point. And as you said, it's a way to radicalize people. That's how people got radicalized in the Mideast. You know, they were kept down and they were denied opportunities. And it was easy to pick those kids off because they were already pissed off about the circumstances they were living in. So imagine, like, yeah, you get separated from your parents. You get locked up in a cage. You're sleeping under a Mylar blanket. You know, a lot of these kids are getting abused and stuff. If that happened to me, I'd spend the rest of my life trying to track down the people who did it. You know, Stephen Miller and Donald Trump and whoever was part of that policy. You know, what was the Kristen woman's name? She left. She was like, you know who I'm talking about. She sort of left early, but she was like a female proponent of that. You know, but anyway, I would be after those people for the rest of my life. You know, I'm not advocating violence. I don't mean, but I would just, like, I'm going to do whatever to screw you guys up, you know? And it's a sin. It's a tragedy, you know? And you're right. It makes us completely unsafe, you know? And it's the fact that they do it by saying, like, oh, it's MS-13 that's coming over here and stuff, like, that they do it under the guise of protection is even more abhorrent, because it does anything but make us safe. It makes the world immensely more dangerous.
And you were talking earlier about gerrymandering. I was thinking about that tape of Donald Trump, that hour-long tape that the Washington Post released of him talking to the Secretary of State from Georgia, trying to overturn the election. And he's specifically talking about Fulton County, you know, predominantly a county that's predominantly made up of people of color. You know, like, it's so blatantly obvious what's going on. If you listen to that tape, it's like a lost episode of The Sopranos, the way he's trying to get that election overturned, because he knows he wasn't adequate enough. He didn't win.
Exactly.
So he's going to do everything he can to try to steal it away from us.
Absolutely. And you're right. It was like a mob boss. And that's how Trump talks. You know, the people always talk about, like, oh, he has dementia or something. The dude does not have dementia. Trust me. You know, he's debilitated because he has terrible habits and addictions and stuff. And he doesn't take care of himself. And he eats cheeseburgers all day long or hamburgers and stuff. But the guy knows what he's doing. And it always comes out when you hear these tapes. You know, there's the Lev Parnas tape when he was talking about Ambassador Yovanovitch, or, you know, the woman from the Ukraine, that he was like, get her, take her out. Like, he knows when his self-interest is involved. And he does, you know, the same thing happened with the tape that came out in January, you know, with the Secretary of State Right. Remember that one? He's like, look, I just need to find 11,582 votes or whatever it was. Like, he knew the exact number. He's like, yeah, I hear you. But you know what? Maybe if you could just find a way to deliver these votes, he knew the specific number. Like, that's not a guy with dementia. That's a guy who knows exactly what he needs. And he kept trying. Like, at first, he'd be like, hey, you'll be a real hero if you do this. And then, you know, he saw that wasn't working on the guy. And he's like, well, you know, people are going to be mad if you don't do this. You could get in trouble. And you heard the same thing this week with that tape. I'm glad you brought it up because he did the same thing. He tried to flatter this woman and she wasn't having it. Like, she was pretty smart. She was polite and played him and was like, I can promise you, we'll go with the facts and find out what the truth is. And you could, as soon as she said that, you heard his voice being like, what, he kept trying to cut in because he's like, that's not what I'm trying to hear, honey. I'm trying to hear you're going to do what I say. You know, and there was also a big poker tell in that conversation because he said, you'll be praised. You know, he said that to her at the end, like, if you do this, you'll be praised. And that's you know, Trump thinks everybody else wants everyone to clap in the room, you know, when he walks in the room, just like he does. Like, he doesn't understand. There's people out there who don't give a crap about being praised. You know, they don't, they're not narcissists who need this constant approval and for people to like them. You know, part of Trump's whole sickness is that he, as bad as he was and as like awful and mean-spirited as he is, he still thinks everybody's going to like him. Like, he still deep down craves everyone liking him. Like, his greatest dream would be like to go to the Oscars and have everybody like cheer him and win every award. Like, he would like that would, he would have rather had that than become president. Most people got that much power. Like, they hang in the shadows, you know, they step back. Like, Biden's a great example of that. Biden clearly doesn't need any kind of victory laps and it's not about him, you know, and obviously, you know, he gave a great speech last night. But let me say one more thing about the Trump stuff. Or what else do you want to say on the Trump stuff?
You can go ahead and make your point and I'll think about it a little more.
Well, it was just back to that phone call. The other thing that was very disturbing is, like you said, he talked about Fulton County, you know, predominantly African American county, but he also name checked Stacey Abrams. Like, out of the blue, he just drops in Stacey's name in there and goes, why don't you go back 2 years and you'll find things? You know, he was talking about her. He was trying to, like, you know, say that she was illegitimate in her capacity, you know? And it was, she's just in voter. She already lost her election. You know what I mean? So I don't even know what his mental thinking was there. I think he was basically just trying to, like, you know, shadow, like, just be like a black person. You know, he was trying to appeal to, he assumed that this white woman he was talking to was going to be racist. So he was just sort of dropping these boogeyman tropes, for lack of a better term, and I'm using that in his ideology, you know. So it just stood out. It's like, well, what are we talking about Stacey Abrams? She's not involved in this election. You know,
well, and it will never happen because he's a malignant narcissist. But you know, I hope that one day one member of the Trump family can feel strong without making other people feel weak. You know, like, that's what they do. They chip away at people's character because they know they're not, to tie it back into what you were saying, they know they're not going to meet them on merit. So they're going to try and make them feel guilty or feel bad about some kind of what they perceive as weakness. We've heard Donald Trump talk about how strong his genes are, right? Like, it's very dangerous language what he's spreading among his followers. And it's like a cult now. Doesn't matter what he says, they're going to go along with it because he's created an alternative reality. You know,
he certainly has. And it is a cult, you know, it is a cult now. And, you know, there's an old saying in Hollywood, Jimmy, it goes like this. It says, it's not enough that I succeed, but everybody I know must fail.
Right.
You know, and that Trump has always been of that ilk. You know, he just wants to ruin people. It's not enough that, like, he got his name on all these buildings, you know, he has to see the other guy sort of get ground in the dirt. And his son's the same way. And Ivanka's the same way in a subtler level, but she's just as cutthroat as they are. And it comes from a deep well of insecurity. Trump was, you know, they covered for him his whole life. His dad had to hide all of his grades, you know? Mm-hmm. talk about the opposite of like having a disability and like excelling anyway. Trump was like, he had a goal, you know, he had every opportunity in life and he made nothing of it because he had no interest in actually learning and actually becoming good at something. Because most people who do that stuff do it because they know they can contribute something to society. You know, they think like, I'm really good at science, so maybe I'll become a doctor because I can save lives, or maybe I'll become a vet so I can save animals or something. You know, Trump was just like, I want myself to have all the power. I want all the men to look up to me, and I want to sleep with all the women, you know, and I want to tell everybody about it all day long. You know, I was telling some people this week about a story, you know, some people I know Trump better than I do. And I don't know him well. My interactions were like on TV shows, you know, I know guys who like play golf with him and stuff. And he would always pull out these pictures on his phone and be like, look at this, check her out, bro. I banged her last night. And then he got in this email chain with these people or text chain. Right. And he would send these pictures around and they were gross. And, you know, guys are guys, right? Guys will talk about girls or whatever, but Trump, my friend told me, always took it to the next level. And my friend had to like get out of the text chain because he was like, this is too disgusting. And my wife is going to like see this, you know, and think I'm like him. But he would just, you know, young girls and just saying really stupid, inappropriate things, you know, and that's how he is. So anyway, there's a story that came out today or came out in New York Magazine a couple of days ago where he went, Alan Weisselberg is the Trump, you know, family attorney for the Trump organization, which was like a family business. You know, it was basically this small business in Trump Tower. People think it's this giant corporation. It's not. It's like 12 people, you know, in an office, like with ratty furniture and stuff. But Alan Weisselberg's mother, somebody passed away, and, you know, they were sitting Shiva at their house on Long Island. And Trump goes out there and, you know, it's just a nondescript, normal suburban house like normal people live in. And he's like, this is the house my CFO lives in. Like, this is embarrassing. He says it out loud at a funeral, essentially, you know. And then he's in the house and he starts hitting on one of the girls there, like the dude's like sister or something or aunt. And he like pulls out his phone and he's showing her pictures of naked women and stuff and then like hitting on her. It's like. But when I read that, I was like, I've heard that anecdote 100 times over. You know, that's who he is. And it's like people, he needs to show people, you know, there's two kinds of guys that like women or whatever. Like a lot of guys that end up like hooking up with a lot of girls kind of keep it to themselves. You know, they're just like, you know, I'm a gentleman. I don't need to talk about that. And I'm enjoying, you know, the fruits of my promiscuity, as it were, you know, between me and that other person. Trump's doing it so he can tell you about it. You know, he's not even so much interested in the act with the woman. He's interested in telling the dudes about it on the golf course the next day, you know?
Do you believe Trump has a God complex? Do you think he believes he's a God?
Yeah.
I'm curious.
Yeah, I definitely do. I mean, he hates Christmas because he gets jealous because it's not about him. That's a true story. He got mad at like a Christmas party early on at the White House. He's just like, I don't get this, you know, and because it's not about him. So, yeah, he does. He has a God complex in that he would blow up the world. I mean, that was part of the reason I spoke out. I was like, you don't get it. This guy would drop a nuclear bomb in a heartbeat if it thought he could save face. Mm. You know, and he brought that kind of stuff up. You know, there were reports early on that he was like talking to his generals and they're like, why can't we bomb them? You know, he was talking about other countries. Like, can't we just nuclear bomb them? Like when he was becoming president and they were briefing him on like conflicts and hot zones and stuff in the world. He's like, can't we just take them out and drop a bomb? And these generals were looking at him like, is this guy out of his freaking mind? You know, and yes,
he couldn't locate most of the countries on a map if you put it in front of him either.
Dude, he couldn't find Indiana on a map. Let's be real.
Yeah, no, it's but he'll say he loves Indiana if he comes here for a rally. And God knows there's going to be a place in Indiana that he could host a rally. There's a few places I know of.
Absolutely. And that was it's funny you mentioned that because during the campaign, he was always like, I love it here in Alabama, my favorite state. And it's like, how many events did you have in Alabama on Celebrity Apprentice? You know, how many like beauty pageants did you host there? You don't love that place, you know? You don't love Kansas. You weren't hanging out and vacationing in Kansas. You weren't going to Missouri and spending summers at the Lake of the Ozarks, right? There's no Trump Ozarks.
Well, you know, maybe with the Netflix series, you know, he'll get some ideas. You know, Ozark, the if you've seen that show, man, that's
That's
a
a
good
great
one.
show.
But
Yeah, great show.
I was watching his CPAC speech. I decided to hate myself for a few minutes. And he's talking about how our immigration system needs to be based on merit when he's the guy who needed someone else to take his SATs. You
Right.
know, like the guy is just a walking hypocrisy. And it's hilarious from an entertainment standpoint, if you want to view it that way. But when it's, you mentioned this in our last episode, when it's, when everything he does is validated with the title of President of the United States, it has an entirely different meaning and context to generations now and in the future. You know, they're going to be watching these tapes for years, man. You could have volumes of stuff on Trump and the trauma that he will cause, not, you know, in the future. We're still not done with this guy. We're still not done.
But not
You
even
know?
close to done. We're sort of at the beginning of a movement. You know, he was the figurehead of this kind of thing, you know, but he was such a dominant force on the psyche of America and American lives. And, you know, not even counting like the damage that was done in the last year alone with over 500,000 people, souls lost. I mean, I just came from a funeral before this, you know, of a brilliant, talented artist, you know, hip hop producer, writer, poet, you know, people. There's people that were giants in their lives and their communities that are gone, you know, and you don't get that back. You can't replace these kind of people, you know. In my industry alone, a lot of people have died. You know, I work in television production in the music industry. A lot of people were, you know, were lost. John Prine is a guy I worked with, a brilliant, you know, singer-songwriter. You don't get John Prine back, you know. So forget about just the cultural and the you know, the soul sickness that we suffered from everything we've lost. Think about, you know, the damage that's done environmentally that we haven't even heard about. You know, the results of all these policies that let companies just dump whatever they wanted to do in the, you know, in the last 4 years. Think about the children, as we talked about last week, that are growing up believing this, you know, that are growing up watching CPAC, you know, and hearing like Fox News still every night. You know, Sean Hannity was on there last night saying Biden should call up Trump and thank him. For what? What should he thank him for? For having a collapsed economy, you know, for having a country in lockdown? Like we could have, here, I'll make this point. This thing could have been over 6 months ago if Biden was president this time last year. I think that's right.
Yeah, no question. I mean, I was going to mention, I saw this graphic on Morning Joe the other day. They compared the 2016 tax cut to the American Rescue Plan. Polar opposite ends of the spectrum as far as the people it's going to help, you know? Like, and we can't be this polarized in politics, you know? Hopefully there's some kind of mean we can rescind back to. I just don't know how we get back there. I really don't. It's going to
Well,
take some time.
it's going to take some time. It's a long road back. You know, it's a long road back. Part of what'll happen is I think Biden has done so much in the last 50 days, you know, and these checks are going to start showing up in people's bank accounts this weekend. You know, this weekend, people might find an extra 1500 bucks, or 1400 bucks. You know, he's taking quick action, is my point, and he's getting everybody vaccinated. Now everybody's going to be vaccinated by May 1st. I think people are going to start to see that and they're going to be like, "You know, this is kind of a lot better than just having it run by a guy who's only interested in talking about himself, you know, a guy who went to visit Oklahoma in July, you know, when we were clearly still at the height of the pandemic. He's like, "I need to do MAGA rallies again." You know, and Herman Cain died from going to that rally. You know, a guy, you know, when Trump had to send out stimulus checks, the $1,200 checks last April, you know, they waited until he could print his name on them. You know, and he included a letter saying, "This is a gift of the largest of Donald Trump." You know, it wasn't a gift from him. He didn't spend a dime of his money on any of his campaigns. You know,
When he only paid $750 in taxes himself, you
bingo,
know?
bingo. You know, and you saw what else he did this week, you know, when he knew he see he's aware of that. He sees how Biden is kicking ass. 'Cause deep down, Trump knows he's a piece of crap, like he always has. He knows he can't read, he knows he's intellectually inferior, he knows his dad had to buy his grades, he knows he's a fat like oaf, you know, when it comes to athletics. He cheats at golf. You know, you and I talked about that. He owns the course and he still feels the need to cheat, you know?
Yeah, he's won championships that he didn't play in. That's how, you know, horrible he is when it comes to competition.
Exactly. Yeah. He had a fake Time magazine cover in his office back in my day. Who does that?
Narcissist.
Exactly. But yeah. Anyway, so he's aware, you know, he knows Biden is kicking ass and he knows that, like, he had a horrible record as a president anyway. But I think he sees the writing on the wall. And that's why he was like, you know, he can't tweet, obviously, but he sent out a statement earlier this week when it became apparent that, you know, this Recovery Act is getting passed and all this money is going to end up, you know, in people's bank accounts. And he goes, don't send your money to the GOP, send it to me directly. Mm-hmm. You know, that was a first for him. Like, he's like, you know, send me your money.
Well, honestly the first direct shot at really trying to split the Republican Party. Yeah. It's not a direct thing of I'm forming the Patriot Party or whatever the hell he wants to call it. But, you know, it's saying if you support me, move your funds toward me, you know.
Exactly. Because it's about the money anyway. I mean, he only sees politics as a way to grift more money into his own coffers. That's his only interest anyway. You know, the whole thing with the FBI building, and he didn't want a new building being built because, you know, the old FBI building was going to get torn down and a hotel was going to go in its place. And Trump got word of that, was like, that can't happen because he knows that hotel would compete with his hotel down the street. You know, he's president and this is what he's worried about. You know, to the extent he got people in government involved in pretending this, you know, making sure this didn't happen. You know, most presidents wouldn't be thinking about that. You know, they would truly have, like, you know, disavowed their business interests, knew they were going to retire wealthy men, and just worried about the once in a lifetime opportunity of steering the course of the free world. Right. But Trump's thinking about, how do I make more money? You know, he's thinking about how many people are going to be checked into his cheesy hotel in D.C. So it's the same thing now with the Republican Party. You know, he realizes if, you know, these people get all this money and they keep it, right, they don't send it to me, you know, and their lives get better, then they're going to start like, man, maybe Trump wasn't so good, you know, and maybe this next guy who comes along and challenges me in the Republican Party deserves my money. So instead, it's like you said earlier, he has to ruin everyone else around him. So now he's in like the scorched earth, you know, Atlantic City phase. His casinos are failing. So he has to make sure the whole town fails. If you've been to Atlantic City, it's, you know, I haven't been there in a couple of years. I was last there in 2015 and it was awful, you know, and we pulled up. Trump was actually running for president that year. And I was on a Crosby, Stills and Nash tour, and I rode on the bus with Stephen Stills, and we did a show in Chicago at the Chicago Theater, and we were going to have a day off and then fly to, you know, to the East Coast. And Stills was like, I don't want to fly. Like, let's get out of Chicago. So after the concert, he's like, let's get on the bus and drive to Atlantic City. And I'm like, that's 17 hours, you know, like, that's a long ride, man. You know, but he was the boss. So we left right after the concert, me, Stephen, and his bus driver. And when we pull off, like, you know, 12 o'clock the next day or 10 in the morning or something, you know, we get out and we're parked right on this street, like right by the beach. And we were staying at Caesar's Palace, like a Caesar's hotel. Right. So we get off the bus and we're all groggy. And right in front of us is the Trump Plaza Hotel, which was already shut down. You know, it's the one that they just demolished. If you saw the image of the thing getting imploded in February, it was that hotel. And I remember looking at it and I'm like, Steven, look at that. You know, the guy who owns that building is running for president. That's what this country will look like if this guy got elected. You know, just an abandoned, derelict, like, health hazard. So, and that was Trump. You know, he pulled out of that town and walked away and didn't care what happened to it. So it's the same thing with the, you know, with the GOP. And they're just at the beginning. He'll wage war on them after a while because he always turns on everybody. That's the other thing with Donald. He turns on ex-wives. He turns on everybody.
Yeah, he's a little to nobody in the end. You have a tape on my show talking about that. But, you know, I was thinking about the casinos and how he just ran those into the ground. How hard is it to really bankrupt a casino? I mean, you have cash flowing in and out. We've all seen Casino, the movie. It shows the counting room. It is difficult to do that, which gets into the whole money laundering aspect of his criminality. You know, it's so obvious, these dots that people just refuse to connect because they've been seduced by his charm. That's a poor word, but it's horrible. It's horrible, yeah. Man.
No, it's totally horrible. And, you know, there's that famous story, like his debts were coming due, like he had these loans out on these casinos and like, you know, at midnight on a Tuesday or whatever it was, like these loans were going to come due and Trump couldn't make his payments. Right. So his dad, once again, in bailing him out, walked into the casino, bought $2 million worth of chips and walked out without gambling with them.
Yeah.
So the money went in the casino and he had it, and Trump had enough money to like make his banknote that night. Like, that's insane. You know, it's insane that daddy would come and bail you out. That's obviously highly illegal, you know, like money laundering. And it just shows who, yeah, like you said, you know, he's a guy who couldn't turn a profit on a casino. And he sent in buses, you know, he would bus in ladies from as far away as like Ohio and stuff and Kentucky. And they'd get on a bus and he'd bring them all into the casino and they'd pump all their money into the slot machines and he'd send them home broke 3 days later. And he still couldn't make any money. You know, he was basically stealing money from people's social security checks and still blew it because he's a disaster. He's not. You know, I've told people this a lot. You know, a lot of people, if they were into money, would take the amount of money he's made and they'd be off on an island somewhere enjoying it. Trump isn't like, he's beyond that in his like depravity. It's not even about the money. Money is how you keep score, but it's like he keeps losing it because he can't help but break things. You know, he's so sort of dysfunctional that he just has to like break everything around him, even if it's his own business.
He's an agent of chaos. I mean, when I hear him talk sometimes, and I compare it to like Heath Ledger's performance in The Dark Knight, you know, like he didn't have the face paint on, but his mismanagement of this virus has caused the economy to be shattered. Our confidence in science has been shaken. I don't know if it's shattered. You know, a lot of people are still wanting to wear a mask and take the precautions necessary, but a lot of people are just foregoing it for political reasons, or, you know, libertarians think it's a violation of their rights. No, it's a public health measure. We shouldn't have to explain to adults that you should care about other people. That should not be something we have to explain. And, you know, if we can't get together on a virus, how are we gonna unite under anything else? You know, that's the great equalizer. So,
well, it's well said, you know, and I got people in New York City that don't wear masks, literally people in New York City that are like, come on with the masks. That's fake. Now they're telling you to wear two of them. Come on. That's BS. People on the Upper East Side, educated people that don't want to wear masks, you know, and that's insane. You know, you think you would want to help other people. You would think, even if you're like, I'm not going to get it myself, but I want to prevent someone else from getting it. But we're fractured, you know, we're divided people, and we're divided on these, like, you know, on these issues that unfortunately are life and death, you know, and he did it to us. I would always say, like, the most dangerous thing is dividing a people. It's the worst thing a ruler can do, you know, a president or a king or something, because once you do that, it's very hard to get back. And this is how I notice it. And I've been noticing it for 4 or 5 years. Like, we're always driving on this road called 684, which is like this road in Westchester outside of New York City. And it's a really nice, pretty drive. And there used to be, like, you know, you would drive and people, you know, you always have bad drivers out there and people who speed, but there would be some like sense of like, hey, that's my fellow driver. I'm not going to do anything to endanger him, you know? And now you get these people that roll by in these massive pickup trucks. Some of them have like these coal burning things in the back of it. Have you seen those? It's called coal rolling, where they take like coal and they burn it in these big pipes and then they'll let it out when they want to. And all this black smoke goes into your windshield. So if they see somebody they think is like a libtard, you know, in a Volvo, you know, or a Prius, they press this button, and it's that aggression. You know, my point is that you see these people driving around looking at fellow Americans as if they're the other. You know, they got 15 American flags hanging out the back of their pickup truck. They got gun stickers and NRA stuff. And, you know, it's like, are you not in Fallujah, bro? You know, you're on your way to Parsippany to work a customer service job. You know, you're not taking Ramada or, you know, Ramallah or whatever, you know, but that's how they're behaving, because they've been told for 4 years that the Democrats are evil, that they're socialists, that they want to take your, you know, they want to take your guns away, and they want to let, you know, Mexicans come across the border and take your jobs. And you can't do that to a people. You know, you have to tell people like, you're all in this together and we're only as strong as the weakest among us. But people don't feel that anymore. And I see it when I'm on the roads. I feel it. I feel an aggression from my fellow Americans that I've never felt before. I turn 50 next week. You know, I've been here a while and I've covered a lot of miles, you know, and it was never felt like that or like it does now. And that's here to stay. You know, that will change eventually, but that's a generational thing. That didn't go away when Trump went away, and he's going to do all he can to stoke those fires. And so are, you know, all his minions, which are their legion now, right? They're all over Congress. Every day I look on Twitter, there's another idiot giving a speech on the floor that sounds like a Muppet on crack, you know, like guns, they're going to take your guns. You know, Lauren Boebert is like an idiot. Like, she's clearly an idiot, you know, like, if she was taking my like order in her restaurant, I'd be like, did you need to write that down? Like, are you going to remember that I said cheeseburger and fries? Cause she doesn't look like she gets anything right ever.
Well, and she released an ad not too long ago this week talking about how Joe Biden is suppressing our right to see the Capitol. Well, if there wasn't an insurrection, maybe we wouldn't need the fence around the damn Capitol. How about that? Okay. Like, sorry for the anger. I'm getting burnt, you know, raged from this. But it's like, guys, do you not have any relation between, you know, cause and effect? Like, take responsibility. Isn't the Republican Party the party of responsibility? They haven't shown a lot in the last four to five years, you know?
Yeah, exactly. She was like, yeah. Madam Speaker, tear down this wall. We put that wall up because you invited your cousins the night before, you know, January 6th to come and attack the place.
And why did she say tear down this wall? To get all the Ronald Reagan people from the 1980s to get behind her, you know? It's the reason why Trump used Make America Great Again. Ronald Reagan used the same language in the 1980s.
I know. I lived through that. I was a kid. I saw him come in and cut, you know, school lunch programs. You know, I lived in a, you know, in a poor neighborhood back then. I had a single mom, you know, a lot of my, it was mixed race where I lived, you know, my friends were Black and Hispanic and, you know, from the Middle East, and they'd bus us into these nice suburbs, you know, and my friends would get a free lunch. They'd get free breakfast. You know, we'd get up early, we'd get bused to school and you'd get a free breakfast and a free lunch, because a lot of these kids didn't have anything. And I didn't have much myself, but I was a little more fortunate than my friends. And I saw Reagan come in and cut those programs. He called ketchup a vegetable. He took away all the nutrition, and these kids no longer got free breakfast. And I saw my friends hungry, and I saw what that did to them. I saw how it made it impossible for them to study. You know, I knew how much these guys and myself were already dealing with. You know, we weren't coming out of the best of circumstances, you know, so any kind of help we could get, we needed. And I saw that, you know, malevolently get taken away. And Reagan was the architect of that. And he did it with that same subtle racism, like it's morning again in America, you know, wave a flag and this like Rambo, John Wayne kind of BS. That it was BS. You know, he's a Hollywood actor. He's a racist since the 60s. You know, Frank Sinatra spoke out against him. You know, that dude was bad news. And I'll tell you one thing, you know, everybody I know, at least, has been on unemployment all year. You know, you didn't used to pay taxes on unemployment. That came about during Reagan. Reagan was the one who started taxing unemployment, you know, and I have to pay my taxes coming up soon. And it's like, why would you have to pay taxes on unemployment? Like, you don't have a job. You know, what sense is it to tax the money that the government's given you to keep from falling like below the poverty line? Now we're going to tax you on that. But that's how it was. It was this malicious, you know, trickle down economics BS that never worked, you know. And I think I've told you before, and I'd like to get into it on further shows, but, you know, Howard Zinn wrote a book called The People's History in the United States, which basically talked about this, you know, how if we're not careful, you know, he was the guy who coined the term the 1%, you know, the billionaires and stuff. It came into vogue much later than him, but that concept first appeared, you know, in his book. And that came out in 1980, you know, and that's when Reagan took power. And it was like they wanted to squash unions, you know, they wanted to squash environmental groups. They wanted to like make government the enemy, you know, and Reagan would say that in his speeches, like government isn't the enemy. If we learned anything in this last year, we learned how much we need government in a society. It's government that's going to kick ass right now and get us out of this problem. It's government that's getting everybody vaccinated. It's government that's getting everybody a check. It's government. The government that's going to pull half the kids in America out of poverty in the next 6 months. You know, it's government that's going to repair these roads that are all, you know, broken down and these bridges that are crumbling. You need a government, you know, but Reagan came in like, it'll all trickle down if we just give everything back to the companies. And what'd the companies do? They went overseas, you know, they got out of here. They got out of Indiana and Pittsburgh and all the, you know, Pennsylvania and Ohio. They hauled ass out of there. And became beholden to, you know, shareholders and Wall Street dudes that were saying greed is good, you know, and Gordon Gekko, you know, Wall Street, all the kids I grew up with were like, that's what I want to be. I want to be a corporate raider and make a zillion trillion dollars by the time I'm 30 and then retire. You know, when you look at those big mega yachts, I know I'm all over the place, but it's all the same point to me. When I go to Nantucket a lot in the summer and I look at these big mega yachts, right? And I'll tell people, yeah. I'll say, you don't get one of those things without hurting people. You know, like you don't get this massive amount of wealth without hurting somebody, you know?
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe a couple people invent something, you know, if you invent Windows, like you're going to make a lot of money, you know, if you're Steve Jobs, but there's way too many billionaires now, you know, you don't need $1 billion. You know, you can be rich without having all the money. I'd rather be rich. I'd rather make $1 million and know that I had 75 people working for me that made $200,000 a year, you know, than make $10 million and know I had 75 people making 20,000, you know, but that's what it became under Reagan. It became this greed is good. The bottom line is how much money you're delivering to your shareholders, you know, their valuations and their stocks. And that's no way to run a country or a company.
Well, and I can empathize, you know, through this pandemic, a lot of small businesses, I know of several in Indianapolis that shut down or are really struggling. You know, I can empathize with that happening to anybody. But this whole debate about, you know, $15 minimum wage, I would sleep better at night if I knew my fellow Americans were earning a decent wage and could pay their bills, you know, and for small businesses that struggle to provide that kind of wage, well, pay as many people as you can, $15 an hour, and then build your business from there. Like, that's fair. Don't hire somebody at a rate that you know you're exploiting them. Capitalism is about exploitation. And good Lord, have we seen it the past 4 to 5 years from the people that Trump hired to be in his cabinet. You know, we're seeing competency finally come back to our government, and it's refreshing.
No, that's a great point. Well said. Yeah. Well said, Jimmy. Yeah, and it is. You know, this whole thing of like, I'm an outsider in D.C. You know, I lived in D.C. for a long time. You know, I worked there. My family's from Maryland originally. I know bureaucrats. Like, I have family members that work at the USDA or work there. And you want policy wonks, you know, you want people that are in government because that's what they're into, you know, and Trump fired all these guys at the USDA and stuff. They fired all these career scientists and stuff and career policy people. And like, that's the dumbest thing you could ever do. You know, it's like taking your car into a shop and the guy who owned the shop was like, I don't want mechanics working on these cars. I want outsiders, you know? No, I want a guy who's been working on that fucking engine for 40 years, you know? Like, That's what we had in government. And that's what he sort of dismantled. And people cheered that on. Drain the swamp. He wasn't draining the swamp. He was the swampiest dude ever. And he was stealing all your money. But people somehow think like, smart people are the enemy, you know, and it's just so stupid. I don't get where they come from. Like, you know, you want smart people like doing the research at USDA. You know, why do you want your buddy that you went duck hunting with in charge, you know, of a federal agency? You know, you want somebody who worked there for 50 years, who knows the people and knows what they're doing, you know, but Trump bought in, you know, Scott Pruitt and all these like, you know, these insane people to run these agencies, you know. Who is the Ryan Zinke? You know, the guy rode up on a horse his first day and made his own flag and raised it above the USDA building, his own flag. You know, he was playing Game of Thrones. Like, he got a job and was like Game of Thrones. And then the first messed up thing that happened, you know, Hurricane Maria, Hawaii loses its entire grid. And the guy gives the contract to his college roommate who owns Whitefish Montana Electrical Company that has 12 employees or something, you know, and they pilfer, you know, $50 billion before they get caught and ride out off on the sunset, you know, and the grid doesn't get built and people are dying in Puerto Rico for the next 2 years, you know, and Trump doesn't care because he hates Puerto Ricans and he, you know, he's getting a kickback, obviously, or whatever money's going to Ryan and his buddy, you know, and that's what you get when you fall for BS, like drain the swamp, you know, that's like purge the hospital of doctors. We don't want those criminal, medically educated people working on you anymore. We want good, God-fearing Americans, you know? Would you
well,
like to say, go.
Let me say that I want to commend the National Guard, especially for the state of Indiana. My mom recently got vaccinated at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, and she had a eyes view of it, you know, and really saw how organized it was. And I want to say, you know, we have a mighty military complex that we can use to our advantage. And we're seeing right now the distribution of vaccines and how efficiently it's getting done with our military doing the job. You know, let's put America first, as Donald Trump has said he would, you know, the past 4 years. And we're doing that under President Biden with the way that the military is distributing these things.
Hell yeah. Well said, man.
Yeah.
Well, Jimmy knows what he's talking about. Jimmy has his own podcast. Why don't you tell him about your podcast, Jimmy?
JBK On Air. It's kind of a creative outlet. You know, it's not going to be every Thursday at 3 o'clock. You know, it's just kind of when I'm feeling creative. It includes a lot of my comedic bits that I talk about. I talk about like dating people with disabilities, the advantage of it. One of them being, you know, we get the best parking anywhere we go, you know. But I'll interview people like Noel. I've had Emmy Award winning actors on there. But like Noel said in the last time, you get to know me a little bit. And if you like me, you'll like the podcast. JBKOnAir.com.
Yeah, and Jimmy, you know, he's an advocate for people with disabilities, but there's nothing disabled about Jimmy, you know, like he knows what he's doing. He's a competent kid and he's helping me get this podcast going. Jimmy's our guest producer again this week and the main man getting this thing done. We're going to try to do this on the regular, and I couldn't think of a better person to help me out with that than Jimmy. So, and he's been kind enough to offer his excellent services. So, you know,
it's an honor.
Oh man, he's a good dude. Well, we're out of time, man. It's been an hour. How does an hour go by so quick?
When you're having fun.
Yeah. When you're having fun and when we're raging against the dying of the light. But actually, there's a lot more light coming into the country right now. And spring has sprung, dude. It's like 70 degrees outside here today.
Yeah. You know, we're in the Midwest, so it changes every 15 minutes. But we're out of the final, you know, the false spring. We're actually moving into the real spring right now. So that's good.
Yeah, same here. I still got snow patches on the lawn, but I saw like there's a little pond we have and there's a I saw smallmouth bass swimming around and yesterday and the turtles are out. I got turtles that are like 70 years old, these big, huge snapping turtles and everything. Yeah. So the turtles were out swimming and they crawl out and there was a coyote came by and stuff. You know, yeah. Letterman lives near me in Indiana. Boy, he lives up the road.
No way. Yeah. His mom used to live in Carmel, the suburb that I live in. Which is 90% white, you know? So I grew up in a conservative, rich town. So being a staunch Democrat is kind of a challenge being here, but having somebody like you where I can listen to your stories and try to connect some dots for the folks out there, it's, you know, I'm excited to be part of this project, buddy.
Well, that's awesome, Jimmy. We're honored to have you and you're doing a great job so far. So another excellent episode in the books. Check us out. We'll be coming back every week, same time, same place, wherever you get your podcasts. This is Noel and Jimmy signing off the Noel Castler podcast. Thanks for listening.